Chapter 36. The Kingdom of Castelshah. I wasn't wrong about the 9 days of festivities. I was invited to over 100 parties and receptions, hawking and hunting, gaming and drinking. My fondness for rushes was used against me, as was my fondness for nubile young women. My popularity was due, of course, to my instrumental role in founding, or refounding, depending on your politics, the kingdom, and my new high and theoretically powerful position at court. While the royal court mage was still in charge of administration and enforcement, as master adept of the royal court, I was in charge of policy, something Pentandra had insisted upon in the order's charters. More, my seat at court was permanent. I was to be included in any war councils or councils specifically concerning magical policy, and unlike nearly every other position, I was not subject to His Majesty's dismissal. Only the Master of Rites, the symbolic reprehensive of the clergy at court, enjoyed the same freedom. I didn't plan on being around court much, but when I was in town I had a seat at Ryle's table that he couldn't pull out from under me. That ruffled some feathers in some circles, but considering Rad had just exploded the chicken coop, that didn't bother me much. There had been some initial agitation to name my royal court position Archmage. There had been far more resistance, particularly among the imperially descended High Magi, in making the change for political reasons. The descendants of the invading Narasi barbarians had a skewed idea of what the word meant, and the Imperial's idea was as much or more political than it was arcane, and that meant different things to different Imperial families. So we went with Royal Master Adept, because it was descriptive. So I got invited to a lot of parties. I only went to a dozen or so, usually when prompted by Penny that Countess Such and So was an important ally, and Master Hoosit's invitation cannot be ignored. I went, I told a few war stories, I played up the goblin threat, I did a little showy magic, made a gracious goodbye, and then went on to the next one. I was also exceedingly popular with the ladies, which I appreciated. Some of them were quite willing to duck away for a little private discussion, but as appealing as the notion was sometimes, especially considering all I had to drink at each affair, there just wasn't time to consider a dalliance. I always seemed to have another reception to attend, another party at someone's palace to drop in on, another temple to visit. And while I did enjoy the attention, and probably enjoyed it far too much for Alia's comfort, but she was in Sevendor, I was a lot more careful about such things now. I had recently had it confirmed by my own magical spy, Yugi, that yes, indeed, there was a baby girl out there in the world with my eyes and her mother's nose, and that had me wary. But it was grueling, always having another noble ass lined up to kiss, as well as having mine kissed thoroughly and graciously by people who did it professionally. I wasn't the only one, either. Each head of each order had gotten invitations and was deployed by Penny and her growing staff like units in battle. Tyndall and Rondol were even in high demand, and they both enjoyed the attention a lot more thoroughly than I. They looked splendid, dressed out in fetching new finery, especially the matching fine cotton mantles commissioned by Penny, or her staff on her direction, in Sevendori green, their snowflake badges sewn on their breasts in cloth of gold, the only retainers I had permitted the display. Their mission was to bedazzle the young noble women of the realm, for which they needed some patient coaching in court etiquette. But they were as important to our efforts as Master Ikarod or General Terlaman or Lord Taran. The goal, Pentandra explained to us repeatedly, was to speak of the arcane orders in revered tones, toast the king's health frequently, and talk about the bright future ahead. If the subject of the war came up, and refugees were already beginning to appear in the area, stay vague but hopeful, mention our victories, forget about our defeats, and quickly distract them with a spell demonstrating just how damn powerful we were. It was grueling, especially the first 2 days. Suddenly, magic was all the rage in the City of 1,000 Lights. Mage lights from every magi capable of casting them filled the air, the massive Irionite green sphere over our rented temple outshining them all. The air around Castabriel was jubilant, once the Dukes of Vore and Merwin departed in a sulk. Neither one had promised war, but neither one had bent a knee, either. That was as good as a victory to King Rhad. Everyone else seemed genuinely happy, as if suddenly having a king to bow to instead of a duke raised everyone's rank. The beer, wine, and spirits flowed like water. The temples were filled with prayerful pilgrims sacrificing to the gods for the health of the new king and queen. Even the Dur Horkan war magi, who were anxious to return to the front, were willing to put their cares aside for a few days and celebrate. I wasn't feeling quite as festive for some reason. It might have been the number of new magi who suddenly appeared at the door of our embassy, commandery, guild. I wasn't sure what to call the building yet, but it soon became one of the more popular stops in the city. Pilgrims gawked at the large green mage light hovering over the spire night and day. But it attracted magi like flies. Every spellmonger and resident adept, every hedgemage and village witch seemed to be bothering the doorman, seeking Irionite or some other vitally important thing, or who wanted to register with the Order, or rail at us, upsetting the old regime, or just wanted to know if it was all as real as the stories they'd heard. They came at all hours, and the first night there was a scuffle in the atrium when an enchanter from Portra and a foot wizard from, well, the road, started a low-powered magical duel. No one was hurt, but I came in at the tail end of it, and decided that was quite enough of that. I asked Telemann to intervene, and he detailed young, tough Sir Rustalo to be in charge of security. After the second day, there were two war magi on duty at the door with mage blades and war staves to keep out anyone who didn't have good reason. "I think we're going to have to buy this place," Pentandra said on the third day of celebration, as we were preparing for the convocation over breakfast. "The facility suits our purposes, with a little modification. The neighbourhood is nice. It's only a few hours from the palace, and you'll get used to the pilgrims eventually. It's just too convenient for us to have a place in the capital." "The winter capital," I reminded her. "We might need a place in Wilderhall, too." That would be harder, but there were some beautiful manors in the Castoli Wilderlands around Wilderhall. I'd destroyed one once, professionally. "And if we're going to buy it, and you say we can afford it, then appoint someone to run it, will you? Someone responsible and jaded and looking for a cushy post, but someone who can keep this place going when you aren't around." "I know," she said, as she unpacked yet another package from her Alka-Alon allies in the empty library of the temple. So far the gifts had been obscure, or fascinating, or both, but not particularly useful that we could see. "I was thinking of Master Thinradl for the post, but needed..." "Goodness!" All of the Alka Alon's gifts were wondrous and mysterious, but this one screamed out with deadly purpose by its shape alone. "Oh my," Pentandra said, covering her mouth with her hand as she looked down in disbelief. In the box was a long, thin object, about 9 inches long and 5 inches at its widest. It was vaguely leaf-shaped, asymmetrical but perfectly balanced and streamlined like a fish or bird. The edge, I knew from legend, was razor-sharp and could cut through just about any armour mortal man could forge. "Is that a thoughtful knife?" I asked, instantly intrigued. Pentandra continued to stare at it a moment, then looked up and nodded, her eyes wide. "What would that do to Dragonhide?" I wondered aloud. "The Thoughtful Knife is one of those mysterious, legendary, magical weapons that we only get glimpses of in the epics translated from the Alka-Alon, particularly those entertaining stories from their warring states period, long before man came to Kalador. One of the more popular legends dealt with three princes of the same house, seeking vengeance, or something, and attacking various monsters, some of which were clearly fictional, with various powerful spells and enchantments in their quest for dominance and revenge. One of the more famous enchantments was known as the Thoughtful Knife. Despite its name, the knife didn't have any independent intelligence, from what I remembered from the epic. It responded to the mental command of its master, with the speed and deadly efficacy of thought. According to legend, it could slaughter whole regiments of loyal guardsmen, or whatever a gas domoloid was, with impunity, in seconds. Like a loyal, thoughtless dog, the thoughtful knife would kill without tiring as long as its master bid. "I can't think of any other reason they'd give it to us," she agreed. "The edge is supposedly..." "I know," I nodded. "More familiar with it than she was, probably. Any idea how to use it?"
"I don't see anything written. But considering its reputation, I think I'll wait for the Alka to show up and teach us."
"That's not something you want to experiment with lightly," she said cautiously, and carefully put the lid back on the box. "What about this?" I asked, opening another box, this one more square in shape. Within was a sphere of glass, or something glass-like, of pale yellow, about 5 inches in diameter. "I have no idea what it is, but it's pretty." Penny gasped again.
"That's a coven stone," she said excitedly. "A big one, too. It allows magi to add their power together directly without going through an apis, which is far more efficient. The bigger the stone, the larger the number of magi who can share power. In the hands of theurgic magi, it can be especially powerful, I've read," she added. "One that size? Maybe 100 magi could share energy."
I nodded, impressed. I could see a dozen different uses for it already. The tree folk had been generous, and that made me suspicious. I wasn't alone in that either.
"They said they were interested in snowstone. Why?"
Penny asked, putting the lid back on the coven stone's box.
"I've done a few experiments on it, and it appears to lower magical resistance, but I can think of 3 or 4 other substances that might do the same, under the right conditions."
"Temporarily," I pointed out. "Snowstone doesn't wear off. It just sits there. They could find that of use. It doesn't require any power to function, it doesn't need additional magic, and the field of effect is inversely proportional to the mass, according to one of my associates," I said. "Gareth had delivered some preliminary findings about the snowstone end of my domain before I left, and he'd established that conclusively. The bigger the mass, the larger the effect. Already the etheric density in the entire Bontol Valley was falling in a radius around Sevendor."
"How much of it do you have?"
she asked, her face calculating. "All of it," I shrugged. "About 6 square miles worth of mountain, and castle, and forest, pond, and fields. Assorted rocks and muds, stairways. The privy I use every morning is made of it now."
"That's far more than I really needed to think about," she grimaced. "But it would explain the Alka's largesse.
If you had something they really wanted, then they'd give us a bunch of bright and shiny enchantments to soften us up," I agreed. "And they would kiss our ass almost as much as the local burgers' council tried to. I think I see what you're getting at. And it makes me want to know just why they want it so badly." We were interrupted just then by someone's young apprentice, who arrived at the door to my chamber at a dead run, breathless. A lot of younger boys and a few girls had come along with their masters and were being pressed into service for the order until proper servants could be hired in the city. At this stage in the new kingdom's history, I didn't want a lot of highly bribable outside servants around. I'd rather be casual and secure than formal and dignified.
"Mage Lord," he said with a hurried bow, "there is a man at the door, a lord who says he has business with the order."
"Which one?" Pentandra and I said at the same time.
He didn't specify," the lad admitted, "but he said it concerned the court mage."
"Which one?" we said in unison again. That earned us a sharp look from each other. The drawbacks of working so closely together.
"Master Dunsellan."
"Dunsellan?" I asked, astonished. "What's the old geezer done now?"
"This should be interesting," Penny said, as I hurriedly grabbed my silly hat.
Master Dunsellan was the last ducal court mage of Castile, and had been one of my first political bribes. I had used the lure of a witchstone to buy his favour at the summer court at Wilderhall last year, and he had been a staunch ally of mine ever since. He was a wily old coot who had affected an older and wiser appearance to help get him his position
and he understood politics as only a mage who has risen to the ducal level can. But he was a powerful adept in his own right. When I had seen him at the coronation, we had only a few moments of formal discussion after the ceremony. The change the Witchstone, and the loss of the bands of magic, had made in him was already apparent. He no longer tried to look older and wiser, and he dressed more like a landed lord than a mage. Nor did he act humbly, as he did when he was at court. He acted more like a mage lord. That, it appeared, was the complaint one Sire Victru of Hunvara had. Once the irate lord was brought in and soothed with refreshment by one of Penny's more attractive maidservants in one of the former classrooms off of the main temple sanctuary. "That sorcerer came back to claim his lands last year," the knight complained after we were introduced, "and he's been goading me into war ever since. My grandsire was gifted my lands by his great-grandsire, you see, and while his family has fallen from position, mine has risen. Now he resents our rise and wishes to reclaim my lands. He has taken two small castles already, and one he destroyed utterly. I can call my banners and lead my men against him, Mage Lord. I can even hire mercenaries. But how can I defend my lands against a Mage Lord without one on my side?" he asked in despair. I didn't know what to tell him. I tried to explain that what Dunsellan was doing was perfectly legal, as long as he didn't violate the Duke's, the King's, laws. As a mage lord, he could lawfully pursue a war of conquest. I pointed out that he wasn't even a war mage, although that was little consolation for the knight. He would have to sue for peace, I told him regretfully, although I did promise to speak to Dunsellan on his behalf the next time I saw him. I also pointed out that Dunsellan's star was rising, and an alliance might be in his best interest. He was unmollified, but grateful at least for the hearing. "That's going to become more and more of a problem," Pentandra agreed after he'd gone. "We're going to have to put some sort of rules into place about mage lords and warfare. Otherwise the regular lords will fall to the arcane lords and..."
"And you say that like it's an evil thing?" I chuckled.
"Penny, I always thought you wanted more rights and powers for the Magi."
"I've read a lot about the various mage wars," she said seriously.
"There's a reason that the Archmage confiscated Irionite, Min. Magical warfare can get ugly."
I thought about the horror of Sherul, and wondered if humans were capable of such things. The look on Pentandra's face told me I probably didn't want to learn the answer.
"We'll study the matter," I promised, "when we get the opportunity. Right now we have more important things to deal with, like the rest of our enchanted presence. Particularly the 21 stones," I reminded her. That had been a crisis waiting to happen the moment the Alka'alon presented us with those potently shiny pebbles. There was a long waiting list of Magi eager to get them, even if it meant serving against the dead god, and we suddenly had a bumper crop and a massive need. Both of the militant orders had made claim to the stones, and I had to mitigate the problem before it became a permanent rift between them. Both orders had excellent points. The Hortkins were in the field, fighting against the goblin hordes daily, risking their lives and slaying a lot of Gervani in the process. The Hessians, on the other hand, were provisioning and strengthening the strongholds and castles the Hortkins depended upon, and also demanded their fair share of the stones. And of course the medical and educational orders made their claims as well, though theirs wasn't as strong as the militant orders. After an afternoon of acrimony, it was finally decided that the new stones would be given out to the orders by sevens. The Hortkin seven would go to the elite war magi in the field. The Hessian seven would be given to defensive war magi who could also operate offensively. As much as I respected Carmella's ability to build an impregnable fortress, these stones were designed as tools of war. The war magi who held the Hessian seven would be the ones managing active sieges or other defensive engagements, not supply clerks and procurement agents. Carmella and her people were indignant over the requirement, but as they were getting an equal share with the Hortkins, who still insisted they needed more stones, they couldn't complain much. As for the final seven, I reserved them as the Master Adept's seven. I would give them to war magi directly in service to me, I announced,
after serious consideration. If, for instance, Master Dunsellan's private war got out of hand and I had to deal with an errant mage, then I needed a force that could be sent to do so. No one was particularly happy about that, not even Penny.
"Why do you need your own private army of war magi?"
she demanded when we were in private between meetings. "They aren't my private army. They are to be used for the Arcane Order's business," I insisted. "When we got rid of the censorant, we inherited their role to regulate magic. That's what you keep telling me. Well, if we're to do that effectively, then I need a tool independent of the various orders. Troubleshooters, trusted magi who can be sent to investigate and deal with any institutional issues, like the Arc Magi's Dabarsi Guard, only with less power. Or, if they're between internal assignments, they would be empowered to assist the other orders as needed, or loaned to the kingdom, or to act as an impartial arbiter in disputes between other orders. I don't know. You're the one who got me thinking about this sort of thing," I said, exasperated.
"It just seems like an extravagance," she pointed out. 7 stones?
"How can I effectively execute administration, or whatever you call it, if I don't have effective agents? These spheres, they're potent, designed to turn the mage into a weapon. My giant ball of magic is the only thing I've seen more powerful, excepting Sherul's abomination. If the militant orders have them, then I have to have them, or I'll have to be the one who intervenes if one of them gets out of control. This way, I have some additional authority," I reasoned.
"I don't know. It sets a dangerous precedent," she said darkly.
"There's a lot of that going around," I shot back, thinking of Isali the Shadow Mage and my secret daughter. Iyugi had confirmed that the baby was a girl, that Penny had forgotten to mention to me knowing about. I suppressed thinking about that further. I had to work with Penny, I reminded myself, and I needed to trust her. I kept telling myself that as I forced myself to switch to a more conciliatory tone. "I'm making this up as I go along," I reminded her. "You're the one who told me we needed some regulatory framework after the Robin Wing Conclave. This would be the executive agency for that framework."
"I was hoping self-policing would be enough," she sighed,
resigned to my stubborn insistence.
"But you're right. You need an independent force equal or greater than those you are regulating. The oaths are nice, but they can be broken, especially if one of the magi goes mad.
It was an occupational hazard we were all aware of. That was what had happened to the Mad Mage of Faris, under the influence of Irionite. That's what had happened to poor young Urik in Bovol, when he had been given more power than he could deal with. Weren't you the one just telling me about the horrors of the Mage Wars?" I reminded her. "This could help avoid that. Besides, our unexpected bounty frees up some of the stones I was going to give to the militants. I'll soothe the medical and educational orders with an extra stone or two. I even have an idea that might make everyone happier with how they're being apportioned." I explained what I had in mind, and she shook her head and laughed.
"That may be the most dangerous and yet most intriguing idea you've had yet," she admitted, after she got control of herself. "But no one would dare say anything about it. I love it."
It was rare enough that I got Penny to like one of my ideas that quickly. She must have been exhausted, I reasoned. I decided to quit while I was ahead for the day. On the third day of the coronation, we held a conclave of the Arcane Orders to work through some business that had mostly been already settled behind closed doors. The tradition of a full conclave, where any high mage from any of the orders could speak, was seen by Penny, Taran, Telemann, and others as an important institutional function, and I couldn't disagree. It's almost never a bad idea to give everyone a chance to talk. Since there were less than 100 high magi in the city, it was easy to do. The temple's sanctuary was ample, and the hardest part was finding that many chairs. And there were some surprisingly lively debates from some unlikely quarters, such as whether or not enchanters should fall under the educational order or have their own. In the end, it was decided to establish a separate order for them, because of the anticipated need for so many enchantments in the days to come. Master Cormoran volunteered to begin the charter-writing process, and a committee was appointed to oversee the matter. I also brought up the subject of mage lords using war magic, or any magic, in inter-domain disputes. While a lot of non-war magi were willing to discuss restrictions, the war magi of both orders felt that would be an unnecessary infringement on their prerogatives. There was passionate and colourful debate before it was decided to table the matter for further study. Master Dunsellan, in particular, championed the right of a mage lord to defend his domain, even if the defence involved an issue from a generation before. There were only a handful of landholding mage lords at that point, so it was more of an academic interest than anything else, but I could tell a lot of the younger magi saw Master Dunsellan with new respect. And of course, there was the presentation of witch stones to the new High Magi. The candidates had been discussed and examined, selected and approved by the head of their various orders, and one by one they came forward and gave their oath to me in front of the entire conclave. And then, of course, we had to celebrate. One doesn't gain access to the powers of the universe without having a drink afterward. I confess, among my friends and colleagues, I was a little looser than amongst the general nobility of the capital. I got stinkin' drunk and shot off my mouth a dozen times. After those stuffy parties, it was nice to be my crude, casual self for a few hours, and by that time I felt like celebrating. A little after the full moon rose, a group of us retired to the roof of the building, 11 long staircases up, with the magi who had been presented their stones. We spent the next few hours casting more and more elaborate displays of fireworks and other magical reveries, a tradition for the newly risen magi we had kept intact from that first day of becoming attuned to the stones, way back at Beauval Castle. Rundahl followed me around to ensure I didn't anger anyone too much, and that I made it to bed intact. I slept until noon the next morning, and the city was astir the entire day over the brilliant light show in the sky. The coronation ball was on the fourth day of the celebration. The arcane orders were well represented, and I was obligated to go by command of the king. I made several of the newly risen war magi attend, just for practice. If the knight mage was to become a regular feature at court and in the kingdom, I wanted the magi who represented their various orders to be able to do so properly. By Pentandra's order, everyone carried their impressive-looking toy staves with them and wore their headgear, or their armour, depending on their vocation. All in all, we cut a splendid figure, funny hats and all. There was food and music from 100 different minstrels, and dancing, and once again I was a very popular partner, and not because I know how to dance. Just after the inevitable address by our new monarchs, I was quietly summoned to an anteroom to meet a young woman. Under other circumstances, that might have been lovely, but the manner in which I was summoned told me whom I would be seeing. When the polite young page told me that my sister-in-law was waiting for me by the hearth, and said it in a particular way, I could tell it was family business, with someone in the family I strongly disliked. My sister-in-law was Radine, who had added a title the moment her father did. She looked utterly gorgeous, and even a little attractive. As meetings with nubile young women go, I'd rather kiss a goblin. "Princess Radine," I said, bowing deeply when the page brought me in and shut the door behind me. "Congratulations on your coronation." The new princess was splendidly dressed in a bright yellow gown, with a voluminous skirt festooned with elaborate embroidery in thread of gold. She wore her shiny new princess crown and drank wine from a golden cup. An empty glass bottle on the table beside her told me she'd had more than one cup. She looked at me thoughtfully and smiled. It was not a pleasant smile. At 16 years old, she had already ordered the deaths of dozens of political opponents.
"Master Spellbanger, my dear brother-in-law, thank you for attending. I thought it would be prudent for us to speak a moment, before the rush of business compels us away from the moment. I see you faithfully executed your half of the bargain. I trust you find we did the same?"
"I have no complaints, Your Highness," I said, the word feeling strange in my mouth. "No complaints yet," I amended in my head.
"Good,"
she said simply.
My father is concerned that the goblins are making better progress than they should.
That is a concern of us all, Highness, I assured her, me more than most.
He's also concerned that you may have made some bargain with the Alka'alon, of which the family is unaware. Their unexpected appearance at coronation was disconcerting.
I assure you, Highness, I have made no bargains with the Alka'alon in His Majesty's name. My discussions have been exclusively devoted to the war effort and magical research. Indeed, their appearance was as much a surprise to me as it was to everyone else.
Can they just do that? Appear out of thin air?
She demanded a little drunkenly. Apparently they can, Highness, I admitted. What we don't know about the tree folk could fill libraries.
So how do we protect against it?
As I have no idea how the spell is done, Highness, I have no idea how to counter it.
That's disturbing, spellmonger,
she said, turning the nickname into a slur.
You're supposed to know things like that.
I've only been Master Adept for as long as you've been a princess. I've been busy going to parties and kissing high noble ass for the last week, so I've been a bit remiss in my studies, I said through gritted teeth.
Don't get insolent with me, Radin said. I did not get to be a princess by ignoring important matters like that.
No, you got to be a princess over a pile of bodies as tall as an ogre, I thought. I was merely pointing out the novelty of my position, Highness. I assure you, I have people working on the matter.
Very good, spellmonger,
she said with just a little too much enthusiasm.
You know, Mother thinks we can still be good friends within the family.
Good friends rarely plot to stab one another in the back, at least in my circles. I countered, but I'm almost as new to the nobility as I am to a position at court, Highness, so perhaps I have been misinformed.
In Castabriel, a dagger in the back is more common than a kiss when departing,
she said, almost boasting.
Betrayal is a hobby. Plots are a way to pass the time. It would be wise for one so new to court to consider that.
Oh, I have, Highness, I assured her, and I appreciate your tutelage. But I fear that the family has put me on my guard, after you ordered my manservant to stab me. She shrugged.
You will grow used to it, spellmonger,
she said with a sigh, and then drained her cup.
Don't take it so personally. Think of it as a test. A less fit man would have died on that field. It's always best to have a secret or two about everyone. That's our stock in trade. But I did not summon you to lecture you, spellmonger. I wanted to extend the peace banner and thank you for your efforts on behalf of the realm. And I wanted to know just when you would be returning to the field,
she added almost casually. Highness, I asked curiously.
What? Oh, I know how the war is going. How the war is really going,
she amended.
I also know the men would feel more steadfast in their defiance if their glorious spellmonger was leading them.
Knight Commander Turlaman is an able and wise war leader, Highness, I said evenly. Should he have need of me, he knows the trick of letting me know.
I am not taking issue with your command structure,
she said sourly.
It's a matter of the public's perception. When the hero of Timberwatch sulks hundreds of leagues behind the lines, people wonder about his dedication to the cause. Baroness Gessa of Gilmora was asking me just an hour ago when the relief troops would arrive in her lands, as currently Gessa's castle is under siege and her husband's life in danger.
The princess eyed me deliberately.
I assured her that our valiant war magi were on the task. Then she asked if Minolan the spellmonger was among them, and when I said not, currently, her face fell.
That galled me. It wasn't that she was wrong. I had been neglecting the war in favor of politics, enterprise, and institutionalization, but it galled me that someone I had so little respect for, hells, someone I actively disliked, was telling me what I already felt guilty about, and her presumption was particularly irritating. Do you expect me to go rescue a friend's castle personally?
No, of course not,
she dismissed.
Gessa's a cunt. Always has been, always will be. But she's not alone. We're swamped with vapid, idiot Gilmoran ladies who have fled south. While our social life in the city has never been better,
she said, with icy sarcasm,
It would be nice if I could tell them that the estates and lands they depend upon to support their time at court weren't falling into the hands of filthy mountain folk, she said, using the polite term for the Gavanni.
Yes, it would be nice, I said, mocking her tone. A lot of things would be nice, but it takes time, Highness. Your father has managed to send only 20,000 or 30,000 troops yet, and that took nearly a year to do. More are being called from the east and the south, but do you have any idea how long it takes to march an army overland, or provision them along the way? We do magic, Highness, not miracles.
I bloody well know it's a problem, spellmonger, that's why I'm telling you, she yelled, losing her temper a bit.
Then she caught herself and attempted to compose herself.
I merely suggest that, from time to time, some news about the heroic victories of the hero of the day would be pleasant on my ears.
You'll get your victories, Highness, I said, nearly in a growl. And when I know how I'll achieve them, I'll let you know. But do not attempt to dictate military policy to me based on politics. She scoffed.
All military policy is based on politics. Perhaps the soft living of a mage lord has ruined you for the field, she mused insultingly. Or perhaps you enjoy that peasant wife of yours overmuch. Either way, Mother expects to see some action soon. Perhaps even the rescue of Barrowbell, if you can spare the time. And I would stop that insolent retort before it passes your lips, she added darkly. You never know what secrets I have against you.
Actually, I had a pretty good idea. Isolde's child, by me, the product of a wartime indiscretion. I didn't know how Ra'Deen and her bitch of a mother planned on using the kid against me, but there had to be some scheme. For the child had been ordered to be conceived by Ra'Deen was insult enough. To have her raise my daughter to hate me and turn against me somehow in the future was unacceptable. I very nearly told her so, too. But I stopped myself. I'd be a fool if I revealed too much in my pride. I was working on the problem of Lady Isolde, but I did not want to make Ra'Deen aware that I even knew of her.
Congratulations again, Your Highness, I said, giving her a curt bow instead. I turned on my heel and left undismissed, with her calling her servants for more wine. Pentandra would have been proud of how I'd handled the delicate situation. I was just angry. I made an excuse and left the ball soon after that. Ra'Deen's crack about my peasant wife got me missing Alia, Minalion, and everyone in Sevendor something fierce. I only wished that there was a high mage left in Sevendor who I could contact, but neither Bannermore or Olmeg had been taught the spell to speak mind to mind. I cursed myself at the oversight. But then I remembered the gift I'd given Alia before I departed, and cursed myself for forgetting about it all this time. The magic mirror. I nearly ran back to the temple, where I took out the enchanted device and activated it. There was little chance that anyone was nearby. It was late, as I said, which was why I was surprised to be staring at Darishi, my son's nurse, when I activated the spell.
Darishi? I asked, confused. Why are you? Mage Lord Minalan, the young peasant woman said, her eyes wide with relief. Thank Ishi and Duin, you responded. We've been trying this fool spell for days and had almost given up.
Wait, what? Why? I demanded, suddenly alarmed. On closer inspection, the nurse did not look well, as if she hadn't been asleep in days. Is there something wrong with the baby?
Alia?
I asked urgently.
No, no, Mage Lord. Your lady and your son are fine,
she assured me.
I will fetch her.
Not until you tell me what's going on, I demanded. She looked scared, but nodded respectfully.
It is just, Mage Lord, I did not want to be the one to tell you, but Sevendor is besieged for the last 6 days.
Huh? I asked, confused.
Sire Gimble has invested the veil and set soldiers to watch the High Pass. None get in or out of Sevendor now. Our frontiers are sealed and guarded. Scores have fallen in the defence. Mage Lord, we are at war.